want to thank everyone for staying throughout the day and hope you saw a lot of great content. For those of you who don't remember me, I'm Scott. I started the day. And we have Dave Campbell, who was second on the day, who's technical fellow in SQL, and Mark Rizinovich, who's technical fellow in Azure. So I think this is an expert Q&A panel. And fire away any questions, and we'll do it also on Twitter. So send your questions to Windows Azure, #WindowsAzure on Twitter, and fire away.
You want to take the one at the bottom?
Well, there's one person here that I got first, so we'll let them.
We should repeat the question.
Yeah.
Hello?
Okay. Yep. So I'm wondering what you need to consider when scaling queues, because it was mentioned a couple times, but it wasn't really gone into depth.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in terms of the queue scaling, if you have specific load requirements, feel free to send me an email at scottgu@microsoft.com, and I can follow up. But in general, I think we published guidance, and there's a good, I think we call it the CAT group, that has a blog and some specific guidance in terms of message throughput of what you can get through, say, a single service bus queue. And I think in general, it's about, I want to say, 2,500 messages per second is sort of fairly sustained throughput that you can get. And I think we have specific quoted numbers in terms of message sizes and throughput and best practices in terms of how to queue and dequeue from the queue. There's a bunch of things you can do with the service bus APIs that are kind of more on the advanced side, where you can do things like batch reads.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually retrieve multiple messages at once, process them in parallel, and then release. And there's some other really good best practice guidance that we've blogged and we have as part of it. And you're going to see as part of the new development center on Windows Azure. Right now, we're focusing a lot over the next couple weeks on the getting started content. You're going to see a lot more prescriptive and architectural guidance get put on top of that as well. In addition to queues, one of the other things you can do and look at is something we call kind of publish and subscribe, or topics and subscriptions, which basically you can think of it as instead of posting a message into a queue, you post it into what's called a topic, and you get multiple subscribers subscribe from that. And one technique you can do if you want to reach multiple subscribers is you can actually have multiple nested depths of pub sub. And so you could actually kind of do 2,000 messages to a subscription and then fan out. And so you can actually get hundreds of thousands of listeners simultaneously if you want to do that approach as well.
I have a question about how the data centers handle the situation of operating system updates. And suppose I had something up there for a couple of years, and then I just got one. I assume it must be getting upgraded at some time.
Yeah, actually, we.
Can you repeat the question just
So the question was about the data center and how we handle operating system updates. I assume you're talking about it from the perspective of operating system updates of the OS running on the servers, the host OS?
Correct, yes.
So the host OS is running a variant of Windows Server, and just like Windows Server gets patched once a month publicly, the public release version, we also patch once a month the data center version of Windows Server. We do it in a way by leveraging update domains in your application so that your app is never taken completely down. It just as when you update your own application code, I think you saw probably several examples of it today, like in Scott's session, of walking update domains to update your application. When we're updating the servers in the data center, we make sure that no more than one of your update domains is down at any one point in time. The downtime is about 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes is what we see that you'll experience as we walk through those update domains, and that again happens about once a month when we push the server OS update across our data centers.
Is there something to say about the surface area, threat surface? I mean, it's minimized
Yeah.
the version. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, we go ahead and update just based on all of the security patches that come out in public Windows Server, although the threat surface within the data center on the server OSs is much smaller than a surface area would be of a Windows Server exposed to the internet, like the ones that your applications might be hosted on in the VMs. The hypervisor security boundary really is the primary threat surface, and that one we haven't seen vulnerability in quite a long time. But nevertheless, we go ahead and proactively patch. We also take the opportunity to roll in performance and reliability updates too into the operating system.
Thank you.
One of the key things, kind of like I talked about in my talk, in terms of how we maintain the 99.95% availability, is kind of as Mark mentioned, we can have multiple instances running, and the load balancer will automatically, as an OS is being updated, pull that machine out of rotation and then put it back in.
Yeah, and we do it, just like when we're walking update domains in your app, we give you this amount of time for your service instances to shut down, and then for them to start up before we go and proceed to the next server.
Well, the beauty is you don't have to write any custom scripts to do patching. If you build the app the way I did it this morning, you'll just get it for free.
Yeah, a lot of people don't even realize that we're doing this every month when they've got applications up in Azure.
And then one additional question, which would be like my manager's question, which is, how is our data safe up there? Because it's all being shared on the same computer, and I understand some of the ideas, but I'd like to hear your answer so I can pass it on to him.
Yeah. How's your data safe? Well, we've got security best practices all the way from the data center management of the infrastructure itself, where we've got cameras all over the data center, where we've got security guards in the data center, where the periphery has got gates and wires and things like that. So physical access to the data center is gated. People can't just walk up and take a server box out of the data center. We also have follow security best practices going from all the way from the server operating system up into the way that we manage the multi-tenancy of our applications. So everything is threat modeled. Everything is SDL. We've got extensive monitoring throughout the system that we're watching for anomalies. We realize that there's certain areas where we have to be just as 100%, as close to 100% as we possibly can be, and those two areas are availability and security. So those are the foundations, the cornerstones of any cloud service, and we take those very seriously.
Yeah, if I can just riff on that point, I mean, just think about, do the thought experiment. If you're in this business, this is one of the things, it's the hallmark, a cornerstone of trust, right? And if you look at effective security, I think a large number of the gaps fall in you. This is just an oversight. And if you have hundreds of different people looking at all sorts of different places, there are lots of areas that have gaps. Here we have teams just focused on this, and Mark and I and Scott all participate in a weekly meeting where we review all sorts of things across the surface. And so this is, it's life itself for us in some sense, so we're really focused on it.
And I'll say that also to continue with this, one of the benefits one of the big benefits of the cloud is the scale, the economies of scale you get with the cloud and the statistical over-provisioning that enables you to get even higher scale by putting lots of customers on the same hardware. But another benefit with the scale comes with the fact that when you trust us with the public cloud, we've got the experts, we've got the top people in the world we can afford to hire and want to hire to manage security and the operations of our data centers. A lot of customers don't have the resources to go and invest in that kind of talent and expertise that you get when you go to a public cloud provider that's running at this kind of scale. So that a lot of times when we talk to customers about what we're doing for security and availability and monitoring our infrastructure, it's better than what they've got in their own data centers.
So what should Jay have done the night they hacked?
What should Jay have done?
We had a demo where they hacked the
show his password.
Not show his password, yeah. Yeah. Multi-factor authentication. I don't know. I didn't see the demo, so I don't know what Jay did wrong.
I think he built an app where he had his SQL password in the code, and so someone from the internet
hacked him.
Hit his box and hit it. So I mean, in general, I think one of the things that you do want to do is try to follow as much best practices as possible. And so we do have some guidance that we've come out with, and we'll put it more as well in terms of making sure you don't store your usernames and passwords in clear text, that you do encrypt it. We do have built into the system the ability so that you can encrypt settings. Mm-hmm. We do what's called key rotation. So, for example, like the blob storage demo that I showed earlier. One nice thing is if you go in the admin tool, you'll notice primary key and secondary key in the admin tool, and there's like two separate security keys you can use. First couple months in the job, I always wondered why there are two. And basically, it's because you can actually rotate the keys, and so you can basically use the first key inside your app, and at a later point introduce a second key and slowly rotate your app code to use it, and then turn off the first key. And so, a lot of those types of techniques we have built in, and, they're designed kind of for continuous updates and robustness. But it's, security is something you got to take super seriously, and You know, I don't think we're trying to say that we have a magic bullet for it.
Yeah,
we're doing everything we can, and we follow some really good best practices, but you're going to need to make sure in your own AFCO that you do the same.
And I'll say that we're not done. This is an area where we're constantly implementing new security features, mechanisms, defense in depth, and so this is continuously evolving.
Yeah, and the other point I'd make there is that it's kind of a bit of a leap, but I talked about the separation of logical and physical administration. The same thing applies in the security realm. I mean, the physical here, you could correspond to the things we're doing inside the data center and such. Logicals, you're still responsible if you've got a password that's getting to your app. You need to take care of that. Now, having said that, I'm also mentioned in the talk I gave this morning that we are getting we have an opportunity to see things from a different perspective. We're getting much closer to partnering and figuring out new solutions to things that for years have just sort of been all your problem. And now, as we're trying to do more things, we find new ways to solve that. I think the key rotation thing, having that available, is a simple example of that.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, just to give you an example of where we're thinking, where we're going with this kind of stuff, we want a future where you don't have to put a password in your app so that it can access your SQL Azure database, where the app can authenticate native using a native identity given to it by the cloud to the SQL Azure database because you've said, you've put on your SQL Azure database, this app can access it. And so now there's no password. It's managed by the cloud, so nothing to lose.
Thanks a lot.
It's on. Yep.
Okay. I was wondering about the federation on the database.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm trying to figure out, how do you decide where to start in terms of the number of shards? Do you just buy as many as you can afford and go all the way? Or, is there sort of a strategy for where you start and where you want to end up?
Yeah, good question. So one of the things we talked about today is you have two dimensions, managing space and managing I.O. The beauty of this is it's elastic in the sense you start as small as you can and then just add federations and add shards as you see the need across those two dimensions. And as I also mentioned this morning, we're providing a mechanism at first, an online mechanism, and at some point we'll get to the point where you specify a policy, and then we can actually sort of shift the mechanism up to meet the policy. So start as small as you need and go from there.
Hello.
Can I amend that? I want to add one more thing. There isn't a notion of segregation. So if you want to say, I want a shard per region, per this, per that, you could enter it into your logical design as you start there. But purely from the capacity and performance standpoint, by all means, start as small as you can.
Yeah, I don't have a question. I just wanted to say about the JS demo. Actually, that's his demo just the public side. You don't need to log in. You can go to type the URL or just delete the record there. So it's not related to the security of the window either.
Hi. Yep. So back to basics. So I'm an entrepreneur developer, and I'm looking to build an application to trace racehorses, trace who they breed with, what they eat, what temperature they are, everything, how fast they race, and so forth, from cradle to grave. So to speak it. And I was looking at the new website, and I noticed we've got .NET, Node, and just everything there. It's really nice. But I was wondering if you could point me in a direction as to which is like the super simplest set to start out with for somebody who's pretty impatient.
I would say right now, I would look at the .NET and Visual Studio solution. That we have in terms of from a tooling perspective and from an overall productivity perspective, I think Visual Studio and .NET are great. I mean, I'm biased, but because I've worked on that for a long time. But in terms of, if you're trying to build sort of a data-driven site, we have the built-in scaffolding mechanisms and things you can use. And I think also right now our tutorials there are the richest. We're gonna continue to reach out and expand our language support. But from our tooling perspective, our tooling is sort of first class on .NET and Visual Studio, and I think that that's probably the easiest path to go.
Okay, thanks.
A question about the web role. Is it easy or possible to do something that's written, say, in Java using server sockets rather than IIS?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's two approaches you can use. Like, one is you could try to integrate. So the question is about WebRoll and using web sockets or sockets?
Java server sockets.
One approach you can do, if you're doing Java, what I probably recommend doing is actually not using the web role, but instead use our worker role. And so we have basically two role instances you can do. One is web, which basically is IIS pre-installed and has like port 80 and already opened up for you. And then worker role is kind of a vanilla workhorse. You can run anything on it. And we have samples in the Java section on our website of how to install Tomcat. And you can basically use existing Java app servers, whether they're free Tomcat-like hosts or whether they're commercial ones provided by others. And so if you want to use Java sockets, I would probably just use Java sockets using the same container that you'd use anywhere else. And that you can integrate and run perfectly fine on top of Windows Azure. And absolutely, you can expose sockets that way. We will, going forward in the web role, be adding WebSocket support in particular as part of IIS 8. And so you can do sockets as well through IIS, but specifically if you're doing Java, I'd probably just go with the worker role because that's probably the easiest to set up. And we should have some good samples and documentation on the website under the Java section on how to do that.
I was trying to follow the .NET sample code that is for the to-do list. Mm-hmm. And I get error at the last step, so will it be possible to address it tomorrow in the lab?
Sure, yeah. I would tell you what, if you send me email about the error that you ran into, okay. I'd love to forward it to the person who wrote the doc. A, they can hopefully help you, and B, we can try to clarify what's wrong in the doc and get it updated if it's a problem with the doc. We did try to run through the doc with multiple people, so it might not be an issue. The doc might not have an error, but it might be that there's something we didn't explain well enough that caused the error. And so if you can send me email about it, scottgu@microsoft.com, we'll make sure we address that.
Sure. It could be possibly related to the TCP port opening, which I don't understand.
It could be part of the SQL firewall.
Yeah.
And maybe we
because
need to clarify.
It's only happening at the last step when I try to publish on Azure with SQL.
Oh, okay.
It works in the first three steps.
Okay. Well, send me mail, and I'd love to follow up on it, and we can make sure. In general, you're going to see us basically refresh our content on the website at least once a week. And as part of kind of going, the new website design that we just went to this past weekend is using Embraco, which is kind of an open source .NET content management system. So it's all running using the same CMS system you can run as well. And basically, we have kind of a pretty regular content push that we're going to do. I think we have one coming up Thursday, which will have a bunch of new samples and updated samples. And so if you send me an email tonight, I might be able to get that updated for Thursday.
Yeah, and tomorrow's lab, you are not saying anything. So is it going to be there tomorrow, the lab? Tomorrow is a full day of lab.
Is there a lab tomorrow?
Yeah.
There is. There is a lab. So good. We'll try to make sure there's someone there who knows this issue. Yeah.
Hi. I've got a question about we've got a worker role with a web service running on it, and I enabled HTTPS with a server-side certificate in the emulator, and we're having trouble getting our custom cert uploaded to Azure, and I was thinking about, it's like, why do we need a custom cert? We should be able to just use whatever cert exists on the machine for the machine identity. How can we, from our web service, hopefully just be able to use a cert that's already there? It doesn't need to be branded to our company. We just need a cert for SSL.
Hey, Mark, I think it's your question.
I honestly don't know the answer. I don't know what cert that's in the machine we'd be able to give to you. There's no certs that are automatically generated for the machine identity. In this case, if you've got a domain join machine, you get a cert there, but these are not domain join machines. They're standalone vanilla Windows servers that boot. I suppose we could generate a cert, but I don't know what the root of trust would be for that.
It would probably be a self-signed cert.
Yeah, I guess if that's a feature you'd like, is to just have self-signed certs be there for you to use as SSL, for your SSL endpoint, that would be a feature request that we could take and consider.
Okay.
But if you want to send us an email, scottgu@microsoft.com, feel free to use me. We do have an enabling SSL and enabling custom cert document that I know. I actually just asked them to rewrite. So maybe you'd be updated on Thursday. But it'd be great to get guidance in terms of if you're running into a problem, you know, is there something we need to do on the documentation side to make that clear?
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Do you want to take a question off the screen from Twitter?
Sure.
You want to do number three, Scott? Can you read it? Allow us to receive push notifications when a role is unhealthy, looking for a push, for example, email or text.
Sure.
Actually, that you're touching on something that's a boundary between me and Scott. So we are going to be.
I knew it wasn't mine. That's why I picked one. So
give you guys something. Yeah, great. We'll pick one for you.
Yeah, thanks.
So one of the big requests that we've gotten is for monitoring of VMs and the status of VMs, richer monitoring. So the unhealthy here, I think, is we do today have a state where when the VM goes unresponsive, it will be marked as unhealthy, but we won't do anything about it. That's kind of, you're crossing into your domain where you know what you should be doing about it. In the future, we will have all this stuff instrumented and available in the portal with rich views. Today, you can see actually it's unhealthy in the portal, but on top of it, we'll go a step further and we will build in notification mechanisms of some kind. This is kind of long-term plans. I know not revealing specific roadmaps or timelines or anything, but we are heading in this direction of richer monitoring for VM instances and role status and as well as notification on top of it. And Scott might be able to add something or not.
We're just talking hypothetically that we might do that. But I think, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do and kind of touched on a little bit in the talk this morning around kind of focus on your apps and not the infrastructure is, you know, how do we make kind of the, I call it the happy path, or, you know, how do you fall into the pit of success as opposed to the pit of failure? And I think the more things that we can build into the system that just give you kind of the things that you want or the best path behavior out of the box. And so having smart monitoring, having smart alerts when things go wrong, and having sort of a policy way that you can say, you know, when this happens, auto-correct it for me, or not even have to ask it, just have the system do it for you. I talked about some of the things that we have there already. You know, as Mark alluded to, there's definitely things that we're looking at in terms of monitoring so that instead of you having to write your own logic, that the system can be a little bit smarter about it and also give you kind of a better view into the health of your app without you having to write any code. Until then, there is a patterns and practices guide that's out there for Windows Azure. It was actually recently published just a couple days ago. And that does actually have a bunch of instrumentation monitoring logic. And so it'll do things like auto-scale up and down your app. And I believe it also does checks the health of your app and does some instrumentation when things go wrong. And so that's also something you can apply. It's kind of shipped as code that you can use. And as Mark alluded to, we're going to be baking that in deeper into that kind of behavior deeper into the platform going forward.
There is a very cool feature that you can switch production and staging environments. So my question is, sometimes we have to keep something on production, like the data and the file. So do you have any solution about that? So my question is, I want to update the code and the data structure, database structure, but only the structure, not data. So do you have some suggestion about that? I don't want to shut down the site during the deployment.
Like one for you.
I don't think so. Because it's a front-end swap, isn't it?
Well, it's a schema.
Yeah, I mean the stop procedure and maybe create a table, but I want to keep the data on the database.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So a couple of things. One, obviously, I talked a couple times this morning about this notion of provisioning a database per tenant. The bottom line is there's a bunch of things that we can do in the schema management space that will add more value here, probably raise its priority now versus when we're just thinking about SQL Server in the box, because people will have collections of things, whether it's for failover or whether it's, you know, per tenant. So those things have been elevated. So we have had a discussion in the SQL Server data tools. One of the things that came up quite often is this notion of data management, reference data management, whether lookup tables or just sort of the basis, because a model consists of the schema definition and then any data you need to get started. So publishing that, management of that, is something that we are looking at going forward. So it's a good point, recognize need.
And what would you say is the guidance for today?
The guidance today are use the tools you have to sort of script things out proactively and consistency. We've got compare tools in the latest version of the data tools. So
I think a lot of, you know, if you want to keep your site always up and you want to evolve the data, typically the pattern I see most sites follow, and this is true for Azure as well as other providers as well, is basically, you know, make the change script to the database to add the columns, you know, effectively add to your schema, then deploy code that uses the new schema, and then at a later point you can remove the old schema.
Yeah.
But basically, you kind of need to do it in a couple steps. You can't just atomically say update the code in the database at the same time. Usually, you're going to need to, you know, evolve the database in an additive way without breaking changes. Make sure that's working with the old code. Upgrade the code to use the new schema, and then at a later point, delete the old schema.
Would you data sync to staging databases so that you could do the swap?
You could. I mean, so basically the way the Azure works is there is a way that from a service, what we call service configuration basis, that you can actually have, you know, a test or staging or production connection strings or mm-hmm. configuration settings. You know, oftentimes I see, though, people in test will use a different test database, but often for staging they'll use the same release database since they're kind of the staging basically just making sure this thing is real before they swap the load. But absolutely for testing you might have a different database.
And to just piggyback on that, I mean, clearly a lot of people are asking for, can I make an efficient replica or clone of the production database for testing purposes, and a variety of techniques we can use under the covers to do that very efficiently and fast.
I think SQL Azure is adding that feature so you can effectively snapshot the database into a new database. And so you can use that for testing and then roll into staging. But it is definitely a tricky challenge. So if you want to make sure your site's never down, you do need to think about these types of database evolutions. And
So we should repeat the question because it was not So just in terms of, would you recommend staging, synchronizing data before making the swap? And we just talked about a variety of techniques that you can use today and some things we'll do going forward on that.
So. Yeah, I have two questions. First one is, what's the plan for the Windows Azure and SQL Azure go to HBI? The second question is, current portal uses Live ID, and for the enterprise user, do we consider stronger authentication?
What was the first question? Did you repeat the first question?
For the Windows Azure and SQL Azure, what's the plan go to HBI? I think currently it's MBI.
HBI,
What's the plan?
HBI, as in high business impact, is that? Or
correct.
So that's a Microsoft internal compliance label. So we've, in Microsoft, we've got LBI, MBI, and HBI for low business impact, medium business impact, high business impact, and this is how we classify the data that we store in our data centers. If low business impact means it's okay if the world sees it, medium, if there's some damage, high business, you know, potentially to our reputation, high business impact, man, the business is really going to hurt if this gets out. So as far as us going to HBI, I think that we're really that external customers really don't care about what we're doing about HBI. Really, they care about what we're doing about compliance and certifications that they care about. And we saw that the core Windows Azure platform components, network storage, and compute just got ISO 27001, that we announced that last week. I think it was last week. And we're working on others that we've got other certifications that if you shouted out certifications that you know that public clouds want and enterprises want in public clouds, you know that we're working on those, and those are going to be coming in the future as well. So I think that's the most concrete kind of answer I can give there, again, without giving roadmaps and
timelines. Yeah, I think there's a set of acknowledged certifications that we're prioritizing and working through. Then there are some very interesting business, high-value business scenarios where we're looking at some novel encryption technologies and such to, and have demonstrated that with some folks in the space. And that's, so a lot of work going on from different ways in terms of how we, you know, create more value and solve problems. But to Mark's point, the things that are the standard certifications, working on those, just driving down the list, we have some other things going on as well.
Yeah. And there was another part to the question, right?
The second part of the question was?
Yeah, so for current admin portal taking a Live ID, so for the enterprise user to adopt Azure, do we support stronger authentication?
Yeah, so the question, so right now we do use Live ID to log into the portal. That is something that we are looking at. Can we open it up to org ID and other type of authentication options? Right now we don't have anything announced, but that is something that we're looking at.
Yeah, and if you think of some of the certifications that are on the list that come to mind, there's some of them that require multi-factor authentication, so we are working on that.
Yeah, and so you know, you'll see us kind of look at that pretty hard in the future.
Thanks.
Yep. I have a question regarding management and instrumentation. And for example, if I'm an enterprise, I have some applications running in Azure and I also have some running on-premise. And I have a system center management environment. Is it possible that my system center servers be able to manage the apps and whatever the infrastructure in Azure cloud?
So with the connectivity solutions that we've got, so we've got Windows Azure Connect, which is this, with codename Sydney, the endpoint-to-endpoint connection, where you can basically domain join and connect to your intranet machines up in the Windows Azure cloud. We've got other connectivity solutions coming as well. Using that, you can point system center machines at them. They don't really know natively how to manage those kinds of machines because they are platform as a service stateless VMs. So you apply group policy to them, but the next time the machine gets moved because, for example, the server fails, the thing comes back and the group policy is not there anymore. Right. So there's some interesting challenges when it comes to managing them. But you can, because they are in your intranet and they do show up as machines joined to the domain, you can manage them through System Center in that way. Now, we are working, the System Center team, closely with us on building out ways to efficiently manage the hybrid scenario and also to make it possible to migrate pieces of on-premise apps to the cloud and vice versa. So you're going to see more of that coming as well. But that's the short answer. It's not a great solution, but there's something there.
Yeah, in the context of these hybrid applications or hybrid scenarios, having one view outside in on it, super important.
Yeah.
Recognize that, and we're working on it.
So. I think we have demoed a future version of System Center that will kind of manage both with a single pane of glass.
Yeah. Well, there's the app controller, used to be called Concero, which is part of System Center Virtual Machine or System Center 2012. But that, I don't think, is the level of management that you're probably talking about. That is more cloud provisioning, assignment kind of management. But they're going further down that path.
Yeah.
And that also runs on-premise and can manage Azure as a cloud resource that you can then assign to people in your organization.
Yeah, any plan that to have System Center products and offered on Azure?
Yeah, I mean, the mantra of the server and tools business, which is where Windows Azure and SQL Azure and the Azure app platform team that Scott's in is cloud first, and so the System Center teams have embraced that as well too. So we're driving forward with making sure that anybody that wants to leverage System Center has a great experience managing cloud resources in Windows Azure.
Thank you.
I wonder if it makes sense to take a second, because in all these questions, I hope things come together in the following way. You go wind back the clock a couple of years. We had a couple of small teams, you know, and on the database side and on the OS side, going towards the cloud. And frankly, from my experience on the database side, there are a whole bunch of people on the regular product like, Dave, what happened to you? We thought you were one of us, right? And we are now, over the last year or so, moving much more towards, and I've spoken a couple times around the acceleration of our learning, and it really is that we are all in, as Steve had said. And it is amazing for people who've worked with the existing product for 10 or more years to see their eyes open to new opportunities, new challenges. And so it's been fun for a lot of people, just a whole new space.
Yeah, and I think this, for me anyway, I've been in Windows Azure for about a year and a half. This right now is a really kind of both exciting and frustrating time. It's exciting because, well, it's frustrating because we get asked questions about where's this, where's that, when are you doing this, and we've got, our answers are vague and it's coming, but it's also exciting because 2 years ago, nobody was asking any questions.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? I'd like to ask a question about the auto-scaling options. What is available right now in the current version of Windows Azure? Can my application to set up a policy to say if I'm running 10 instances and a certain resource, CPU or memory, goes to a certain, again, threshold, I want to spin another instance? So that's the first question. What is available right now and what is coming possibly? And the second question, can I predefine maybe a subnet somehow in the Windows Azure portal, say, like, I want to run instances in 10.10.something, whatever is available. Maybe you can give me a choice. So my network application can be pre-configured, pre-anticipate that subnet, so I can kind of rely on not whatever the group of that subnet is, but is anything coming from that direction?
The first part of the question, I'll actually have Mark ask the second part. Okay. On the first part of the question of, is there ability to kind of auto-scale so that yes. If I have 10 instances, my CPU is above or below a certain threshold, I either add or remove resources. That's not built into Azure today. Although we expose the monitoring hooks necessary for you to implement it. And so I mentioned earlier the sort of patterns and practices guide that we've shipped last week. That does include the code in order to enable that type of auto-scaling capability. Okay. And so there's a pretty good guidance about how you can implement that. So it's not quite just built into the portal. We are looking at enabling that in directly, but it is now possible to do that, and we have some good guidance on that. In terms of subnet.
Yeah. So the second part of the question was, can I bring my own IP address range and apply that to my hosted service?
Oh, whatever the range you can maybe, yeah. I can specify or can expose.
Yeah. So basically arbitrary. We call that bring your IP addresses to the cloud. And the answer to that, I bet you can guess what it is based on the previous answers I've been giving, which is stay tuned.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, folks. My question is on debugging, and there are two parts to it. What is the remote debugging story in Visual Studio? Can I remotely debug the web role or worker role from Visual Studio? And second, can I trigger, say, process dumps if I suspect my web role is hung or it's not performing very well? And can I look at process dumps using WinDBG or something fancy?
Yeah, so in terms of the tools, we don't have an auto remote attach on VS yet. That is something we're looking at adding. There is the ability to do process dumps as well as profile dumps as well as IntelliTrace dumps. And basically you can write that to blob storage, and then inside Visual Studio you can actually open them up and analyze them on your dev machine. And so that is built in, and that's part of the tools that you can take advantage of. It would be nice to be able to basically just say, I want to set a breakpoint on my remote instance when it triggers fire. That's not implemented just yet. If you want to, you can install Visual Studio. Kind of showed you remote desktop earlier in my demo. You can, for example, install the VS Debugger or just like WinDBG inside the role and use that remote desktop in today. But we don't quite have the end-to-end. You just set a breakpoint inside your dev machine connected to the remote instance and use a remote debugging protocol. We don't have that quite yet, but that is something we're looking at adding in the future.
In the back?
Earlier, Mark mentioned about the HBI, MSI, and the LSI space. Now, do you see that the current Windows Azure, with its current security in place, is ready to be adopted in the HBI space for a company even within Microsoft? Or if not, do you see that as an opportunity?
So today, Azure is certified for Microsoft MBI internal use. The question was, what about HBI? Do we care about that? Or is that an opportunity? The answer is, yes, we're working on it.
So when
so, do you, I can't give you any date.
Okay.
Sorry.
We're working hard.
So I have a question on the portal and management. So I've not seen it the latest version, but is there a way wherein I can set some limits and kind of, you know, automatically trigger like mails or alerts saying, hey, you know, I set, you know, limit for bandwidth or, you know, the CPU usage or basically whatever compute instances, whatever, right? So what's the plan around that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's potentially two types of limits you want. One is, you know, can I get notification, like if my CPU, so the question is about monitoring effectively in your app. You know, can I get CPU limits, like am I running into a threshold where I need to scale? I think you were referring more to, though, you know, can I get limits so that I understand what my bill
right.
is?
Both, yeah. Actually, right? Okay. I mean, yeah, so one thing is, yeah, so basically you want to take an educated decision, right, informed decision saying, hey, you know, okay, you know, I can scale, but hey, you know, this is my budget. So regardless whether I can scale or not, beyond this, I don't want to.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, so two things. So on the Dev Center, there's under the common task section, there is actually how you can get perfmon data and diagnostics data. And so you can capture things around CPU and memory. And I mentioned this patterns and practices guide that shipped earlier or last week, where you can use it to dynamically spin up or spin down instances. So on the runtime monitoring side, that's instrumented, and you can build apps that take advantage of that. On the budgetary side, one of the big things that we shipped this past weekend was the ability to kind of see your bill in real time. In the past, it was kind of you'd get the bill at the end of the month, and sometimes people would be surprised at the bill, or go, wow, I forgot that I left that running, or boy, that app was popular.
And then they'd be surprised.
And often not pleasantly slow. And so one of the things that we did as part of the new website refresh is now you can always click on the account tab, and you can look at all the subscriptions that you have, and you can see exactly how much you've been billed. And it's pretty close to real time. I mean, it's different services sometimes have a few hour latency delay. So, for example, compute, I think we update every 4 hours, whereas some things we update every hour. But it basically allows you to kind of just hit refresh and see exactly what it is. It's also possible to get access to that data using a comma-separated version, a CSV format. And so if you want to programmatically get it in XML or it's comma-separated format, you can pump into Excel or run your own program analysis against to look at your budget and see what you're using. Right. It's also possible to get very detailed. You can even see what zones your traffic's coming from, what your bandwidth cost is for different features, et cetera. And so now you have that visibility, you're going to see us add even richer monitoring. And we don't have the auto, when you hit this threshold, send me an email yet, globally across the system. We do have it for free trial as well as for MSDN accounts, where we allow you to set a budget cap, where you basically say, never charge me for a free trial, never charge me for an MSDN subscription. That's the default. As you approach the limit of your trial, meaning like you have 750 free hours, if once you get to say 600, we will send you an email saying, hey, you're starting to run up against your limit, just a heads up. And so we will give you notifications there. Longer term, we're looking to allow you to sort of say, this is my budget, send me email when I look like I'm going to go over and I can decide what I want to do.
Right. Another ramification of it is, you know, kind of security, right? Because, you know, hey, based on even, you know, your bill based on the traffic, right, the network utilization. So someone trying to, you know, bombard my site with, like, you know, so I understand, like, the first hit won't count, but, you know, someone has access to the second level page or whatever. And I know there's application responsibility as well, right? But let's say someone gets past that, right, then people can actually make me bankrupt. I mean, I'm just saying in a lighter sense, but, you know, there is this possibility, right, without checks and balances, you know, someone can kind of hit my site, and then all of a sudden I realize, like, you know, there are like 10 million hits on my site, and then, which might be a, you know, kind of a small small business app, and then, you know.
Well, one thing is we no longer charge for any incoming traffic, so you know, you don't have to worry about someone just sort of trying to upload 10 megabyte files to your site, right, and, you know, charging you based on that. All incoming traffic to Azure now is free. It's only outgoing traffic that you're charged for, and it's 12 cents per gigabyte. And so, you know, for a single tenant to hit you you know, charge you more than $10, they're going to have to throw a lot of load at your system. You know, we would interpret that typically as a denial of service attack.
Right.
I don't think we charge for denial of service attacks. I think we waive the charges in that case.
Right. and we are working on denial of service attack
protection
yeah, that you can opt into, too.
Okay. So we think someone is being denial of service. We do block it at the network level.
Okay.
We don't guarantee that, yeah, but our system, we keep an eye on it, and we will block people when they're denial of service attacked.
Okay. So, can I take another one from the feed here?
So. Yeah.
Sure.
What about the one off the bottom? The dev update fails. Will it roll back to the last good instance or state?
That's a good question. So the question is, if I'm updating my service and I realize that something's wrong, will it roll back? The answer is it will stall. Will stall indefinitely waiting for the instance to come healthy if one is unhealthy before we move on to the next update domain. You can, as of about a month ago, we made it possible for you to manually go initiate a rollback of a stalled deployment like that. So you can say, go ahead and go take those instances back to the previous version if you realize something's wrong. If you get all the way through the deployment and the instances came up and said they're healthy, but your application, as you understand the health of it, is unhealthy, it's at that point it's your responsibility to go and take basically roll back by doing another deployment of the previous bits and config to get it back to the old state. We don't have any support right now where you can click a button, we've saved the previous version across a successful update and let you roll back. But, you know, depending on that, again, going to what Scott talked about earlier, if we see a lot of customers wanting that kind of support, that's something that we'd consider putting back in, or at least making it easy for you to capture that previous bits. And
in general, I'd say anytime you're doing an update, if you want the ability to kind of immediately roll back, you know, look at using that staging production feature that I showed this morning, because the nice thing is that's built into the system, and that does allow you to keep instances hot. And so if you need to do a rollback, it's not a multi-minute process, it's a couple-second process, and your instances are already warmed up, your cache is already loaded, and your app's ready to go.
Yeah, and I think even solutions like TFS, though, will allow you, if you're managing and deploying your service through something like hosted TFS, then that will have your previous versions and allow you to roll them back that way, too.
Yeah. Hello?
It's an API. I'm not sure if it's in the portal UX. I haven't played with it, but it's definitely an API.
Hi. I have two questions. One is regarding that it has been mentioned as part of a scale-out strategy, the asynchronous operations we can move into a worker role project. So how do we get invoked in the, cloud computing directly over there? The second one is regarding the TFS integration on, with respect to Windows Azure build and deployment.
Yeah, I think I can answer those two. So the first one was around kind of, as one way to scale out, can you move more things to be asynchronous and leverage worker roles in the back end to do actions that are not blocking UI, say, in a web role? And I kind of showed that a little bit in my first talk this morning, where I showed the web role posting a message into service bus queue. And then and this morning, I actually just had a command line XE running my laptop, pulling the message and processing it. What you can do is you basically just create a worker role with effectively that same while loop that's processing messages from the queue, and just deploy the web role and the worker role using a queue to coordinate. And that's a great way to get kind of async behavior. And you can scale out your workers or your web depending on where your load is. So that's probably the best practice in terms of doing it that way.
I just want to know that how it get invoked, that worker role thing. Is part of the application itself get invoked, or as a part of it's working as another instance?
So the question is, how does the worker role get invoked? So when you're in Visual Studio, I showed taking an ASP.NET project and enabling an Azure deployment, enabling it and deploying it. And that was kind of a single web role that effectively was deployed into Azure. What I could have also done is inside that deployment project, just right-clicked and said add worker project. And then I'd have another project inside my solution, and that effectively has like a program.cs file. I think it's called worker role.cs file. And it effectively has the equivalent of a main statement. I could start. And what you do is you just put your while loop inside there, and basically when that worker role comes up, it'll start doing that while loop. And what you can do inside that while loop is like I did in the command line XE, you just listen on a queue or a set of queues. When you do, say, queue.receive to go receive a message, I think by default it's a 90-second timeout, and then it'll return null if there's no messages, and then you just infinitely do a while loop inside there. And if there's a message, you process it. Otherwise, you'll wait until a message arrives and process it. And then you just need to poke messages into the queue. As well as some samples, and there's a tutorial that's out there now, and it's going to be simplified in a new version coming out on Thursday morning, which basically shows how you can do that kind of async processing where there's a web role and a worker role communicating with a queue, and that'll show up on the .NET Dev Center on top of Azure on the Develop tab. Your second question then was?
TFS integration with the...
Yeah, TFS integration. So one of the things that we did, I showed kind of how you can download that publishing profile configuration file and then use the IDE inside Visual Studio to push deployments in a graphical way. We're also coming up with some good DevCenter guidance that will be coming out either in the next couple days or first week of January we're trying to figure out if the person can write it before they disappear for the holidays. But that will actually show how all the steps for automating a TFS build server to basically push deployments inside Azure in an automated way. And so we'll have kind of step-by-step guidance on how to do that. And basically you can do it either like a build each night to staging or to a test branch, or we'll also show how you can wire up what's called continuous integration so that every time someone does a check-in, the build server kicks off a build. And if it's successful, then you can automatically push it to a testing branch inside Azure.
Thank you.
There's a question over there.
Good. This is a very exciting presentation. Thank you for all of the amazing work. Can you hear me okay? I work for a coalition of human rights organizations, and we're heavily considering Azure, but we have some concerns. One of the things that one of our members, Benetech, expressed in Palo Alto, this actually came from a meeting I had a few days ago with Todd Perry, who you may know his name. He was Mark Zuckerberg's teacher at Stanford and one of the early Facebook executives. And he's involved with us as well as some other folks that you might know. In your Microsoft Online Services use rights, October 2011, I was looking at the scope of use. The particular use case we're talking about here is human rights databasing applications that are for instance, victims of human rights abuses in different countries, which I'm heavily involved with. And what I'm curious about is Benetech, for instance, has an application called MARDIS, which is a kind of pioneering application that allows people who want to make a report about a human rights violation available, and it has a fairly serious, you know, crypto capability with public and private key components, obfuscation if someone's captured. We're thinking about rolling similar tools like this out on Azure. And along with a number of other things for, you know, disaster relief zones, you know, rapid assessment of things that are happening. Many of these kinds of tools involve immediate conflict with local, regional, national, international jurisdictions, which have, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, a whole variety of different opinions about what uses are and are not available for information. Microsoft, of course, is a power in 100,000 different ways across the world, and we all love Microsoft. I'm curious about Azure. How are you prepared to deal with the implications of human rights organizations constructing applications on your platform in a legal and political sense? Thank you.
That's an interesting question. You guys want me to take that one?
Yeah.
Sure. I'd frame my answer this way. Look, it's a great, serious question. We have had discussions of that form. There's so much there. That's not really something that I can sit here, pretend I understand it, and give you an answer that I'd feel at all confident with. The thing I'd suggest is, instead of sending that one to Scott Kuhy, you can send that one to davidc@microsoft.com. We do have people thinking of those types of things. That's not to say we have a solution in our head or imminent, but we have had similar forms of discussions, and we always learn something. So send me a mail. I'll connect with some folks who can have a more thoughtful discussion with you. Okay?
Can you talk about security? Can you compare? So we've actually traditionally put out a lot of guidance in terms of how to harden applications today in the premise world. What new kind of things should we be thinking about going into the Azure world? Can you talk about that? I'm not looking for specific, more broad points. What new attack surfaces do you see coming up? What kind of things that we as developers should be thinking about?
It's a good question. I mean, it's a very good question. I mean, I think you'll see us, you know, produce more guidance specifically of like checklists to follow and things to double check in the similar ways that we've done with the patterns and practices for on-premise. I know that's something that we're looking at. And, you know, in general, I'd say, you know, one of the things that, you know, people typically look for, and especially if they're going to a new platform, is having that kind of prescriptive guidance. And I think that's going to be something that hopefully we can differentiate on in terms of having that level of detail and having those checklists that you can follow. You know, in general, you know, I think, you know, the biggest guidance I'd give is probably be conservative and, you know, don't open things up that shouldn't be open. You know, really think through in terms of everything you're exposing, how are you exposing it and doing the threat models for it. And there's some good, you know, security practices like, if you remember the Michael Howard's book.
Code Secure.
You know, there's some good stuff there that's kind of not, you know, not specific to on-premise that I think applies to the cloud in terms of really kind of doing threat modeling and thinking through that. And so if you are, you know, building a serious app, that's a good book to look at. And I think you know, follow those guidances, and I think that will help in a broad sense and make you think through that. We do, I think, a number of things in terms of, I mentioned earlier, like the sort of philosophy of how do you fall into the pit of success as opposed to the pit of failure. And so there are a lot of things in Azure where I think we've chosen smart defaults that can help guide you towards that. And I'll give two simple examples. One is the SQL Azure Firewall, which allows you to control what ports or what IP addresses can access your SQL Azure database. There's times that as a developer I curse it because I'm like, oh, I just went home and I got to change my firewall rule to adjust for home. But it's a good example of being secure by default where you don't inadvertently allow someone on the web to start poking at your IP address of your database. And I think having that on by default just means that that's one less accident to happen. And I think the other thing that Windows Azure's done well is, by default, when you deploy an instance into the cloud, a compute instance like I did with ASP.NET, you have to explicitly indicate what ports you want to open. And for an ASP.NET app, we do open port 80 by default, since by definition you're going to need port 80 typically. But we're pretty careful not to open any other ports on the box. And Windows Azure will create a firewall automatically around it to kind of protect it. And having some of those smart defaults, I think, doesn't guarantee success, but hopefully does mean that your app by default isn't wide open to attack. And I'd recommend reading a book like Michael Howard's Secure Code or Code Secure, because that has some good threat modeling techniques that you can use as well.
I think that the big shift in a lot of people's thinking is if they're coming, especially from a line of business world where they're writing apps that run in their own data center, they're sitting behind a firewall, and that tends to give them the sense of security. When you go to the public cloud, those endpoints potentially are sitting out there on the open internet. And actually, I don't think that the threat really changed. It's the perception of the risk of the threat. Mm. And I think that that's also, if you look at the number of attacks and the ways that people are trying to get at data, that the firewall really doesn't mean much anymore. The corporate firewall doesn't mean much anymore. And so this just highlights, though, the fact that you're sitting there out in the open and people are going to try to get to you.
And I would say, for people that are like, hey, I got this app that I think I can mostly move, but there's some critical resource that I, either for security reasons or regulatory reasons, I can't easily move to a public cloud environment. I look at that demo I did this morning where I showed a mobile device connecting through a WCF service through the service bus to a local database. That's another approach you can take where if there's something really super secret or confidential that you just can't move or don't feel comfortable moving, expose a WCF service that provides just the lens into that data you need, ACLE that service, and then you can actually have other parts of the app live in the public cloud. And that's a pretty easy way both for code migration as well as for security that if you're not ready to put that in the cloud, you can still build an app that takes advantage of it that runs in the cloud, and you can keep that data on-premise.
Well, I think we'll get to wrap after this one.
Yeah, one more question. Yeah. Okay.
Hello. Thank you very much for your demos today. I like especially the one where you spin like Azure modeler, but are any plans to bring Azure in local data centers? Like we have a lot of infrastructure already built in, right, and hardware, and we would like to utilize hardware, but Azure way, and it will help us in the future. For example, a time when we outgrow our existing hardware, we can move partially to Azure or completely to Azure. And kind of running like Azure tools, you show a lot of great tools, will be really helpful for our local data centers. Thank you.
One of the things that we have announced is this thing we call the Azure Appliance, which is basically a way that people can run the Azure environment, including deployment, everything we showed today, basically in their own data center. And we have a couple of hardware vendors like Fujitsu that are manufacturing these appliances, and we have companies like eBay that are actually installing them in their own data centers. Right now, the appliance is still pretty big. It's not kind of designed for a typical, frankly, even a typical enterprise environment. It's usually for very large data centers, but it is something we're looking at. And in general, I'd say even absent of saying we're bringing all of Azure down, one thing that's nice about Azure is the fact that it is running Windows just like Windows Server on-premise. You're using SQL Azure that has symmetry with SQL Server on-premise, and you're going to see a lot of our app platform pieces in the future have symmetry across Windows Server and Windows Azure, and we're definitely looking to try to have a kind of consistent development app platform story so that you can basically write to a common set of APIs and take advantage of that symmetry both from an app dev perspective as well as a management perspective. So I think you'll see more of it from us on that in the future.
I think with that, we have to wrap because James is going to come up and show us off, right?
Yeah, I want to say a huge thank you for everyone coming today. And I think James is going to give some giveaways, so don't leave just yet. But thanks so much.